Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 163 of the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, and Andrew Frankel, my co-host. Now, it's a bit of a magazine-style show this week because we're covering lots of ground. We've got news of a couple of British sports cars, and then later on we're debating whether or not we prefer sports cars or supercars. That's all to come. Before that, I will just remind you all to rate and review the podcast. And while you're doing it, just hit the follow button or hit the subscribe button on whichever app you're using to listen to this. That really helps us a lot. Thank you for doing that and enjoy the episode. There's some news that we need to discuss to get this episode underway, Andrew. News of an Aston Martin, which we'll come on to in a little bit, but also an interesting new Caterham, potentially interesting. And I want to get your views on this thing because they've called it EV7. It's an electric Caterham. And actually, for now, it's a concept. And I think all we've seen are some renders. So I don't know what state the actual concept car is in.
Well,
is there
I think it's going to be running at the Festival of Speed, which I think is the end of June. So
you'd hope
if it's not running now, it's going to need to be fairly shortly.
Yeah, okay. So we'll see the actual thing soon. That's good to know. But let me just sort of run through some of the specs. It's got a 51 kilowatt hour battery. They say 40 kilowatt hours usable. So 51 kilowatt hour, actually, that seems fairly large to me. I mean, something like a big Tesla might have a 100 kilowatt hour battery.
Yeah.
That is enormous. So 51, it's half the size of that. So it's still fairly substantial,
well,
isn't it?
It's something like an electric Mini.
Mm.
Has got a 30 kilowatt battery.
Has it really? So, only 30?
Yeah.
Goodness me.
Yeah, no, it's not. But I haven't done this. I had one in recently, and I just I was amused to note that the size of the battery in that pure EV Mini was the same size as the battery in the plug-in hybrid Mercedes S-Class. That's what that's really why I know. I can't imagine that a Honda E's got a bigger one than that. So it is, for a little car, it is quite a big battery, isn't it?
So it'll presumably have decent range based on that battery capacity.
Except they haven't said anything about that.
No, no.
Well, they've come up with this sort of slightly strange 2015-20 formula, haven't they?
Yeah. Yeah, the idea being, is it 15-20-15? I think that's right, isn't it? You can do 15 minutes of track driving. Or is it the other way around? Is it 20-15-20?
I think it's 20 minutes of track driving, 15 minutes on charge, and get another 20 minutes of track driving.
Yeah, which is great as long as you've got the right kind of fast charger in the paddock. But actually, you know, if it genuinely does do that, I think that's enough. You never need to do 30 minutes in a stint on a track day, do you? You'd be exhausted.
No, but it is so dependent on, you know, tracks investing. You know, I don't know. I mean, maybe there are. Maybe I'm doing tracks a disservice. I don't know any tracks in the UK that have got fast chargers. And by fast chargers, I mean, I think this thing is meant to charge at about 150 kilowatts, isn't it? And it's, you know, I don't know any circuits that's got, you know, they might have a few fast chargers in that they might charge at, you know, 7 kilowatts or 22 if they got three phase, but you know,
yeah. It's all in theory, it's going to be
the major circuits that invest in that. I mean, I can't imagine, yeah, you know, super fast charging turning up in the paddock of Mallory Park anytime soon.
So this thing, we're told, we don't know what the range is, and actually aerodynamics, that's a factor, isn't it? Because
massive.
A Caterham 7 doesn't have aero. it's like a house brick.
No, but I've got something interesting to say on that, but I'll come back to it in a minute.
Okay, so it weighs less than 700 kilograms.
Yeah.
We don't know the exact figure, but less than 700 kilograms, which, I mean, that is a fantastically light car by any standards, apart from
normal Caterhams.
Caterham 7 standards, isn't it?
Yeah.
But even so, you know, I think that's pretty good going. I do wonder about the size of that battery. You know, if they'd taken a chunk out of that and that saves 50 kilograms, that's worth doing, isn't it? I suppose we'll know more when we hear about the actual on-road range of the thing. Maybe that will explain why.
Yeah.
Plenty of power, though, 240 horsepower.
Yeah.
Single motor. But we know that... And do you know what? They've also quoted the RPM at which that power is produced, 9,000 RPM. It's weird to see that quoted for an electric motor, but this sounds quite exciting, doesn't it, now 9,000 RPM?
Yeah, I mean, but do you remember when they always used to quote the speeds at which turbochargers spun? I can remember being terribly excited when I discovered my Renault 5 GT turbo spun at 80,000 RPM.
Like it meant anything, yeah.
Yeah, unless it's an internal combustion engine, to me, it's a completely meaningless figure.
It doesn't matter, does it? No, it doesn't matter.
No.
They say 4 seconds, 0 to 60, 130 flat out.
Yeah.
So it'll be brisk. I mean, you don't need any more performance, really, than that from a 7.
No. Arguably, you know, given the sort of person who I suspect is going to buy it, you might be able to get away with less.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. So we hopefully... This isn't just a technical exercise. Hopefully it's not just a PR exercise. Hopefully they're building up to actually producing a showroom car that people can go out and buy, because I just want to drive one of these things. I want to know what that feels like, a 7 with an electric motor, with a battery in it, and what are you missing? The soundtrack, and a good snorty four-cylinder soundtrack is such an important thing in a Caterham, I think.
And a
manual gear shift. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Can I give you my take on this thing? Okay.
You can.
So I think this car is... And I don't know any of this. So it's not as if I'm sort of giving the nod and the wink about some inside knowledge that I actually have but can't tell you about. I don't. But nevertheless, so this is just pure supposition on my part. Nevertheless, what I think this is a stalking horse, because what they have also said is that there's going to be another electric Caterham concept. I think they said we'll see it before the end of the year. So the question is, why do two? And I think this car is all about getting people comfortable with the idea of there being an electric Caterham. And I think the Caterham 7, in its totally unaerodynamic shape, is just not...
I see where you're going.
For want of a better phrase, vehicle for doing it. So my guess is that at the very least, they will have put a new body on the 7, a super aerodynamic body on the 7. Bear in mind also... that the sort of person I think this is going to appeal to, it's not going to be, you know, people who, you know, like their 620Rs. This is going to be people who like the idea, because let's face it, there aren't any at the moment, of a lightweight sports cars in which to go cruising around the place, probably not at huge speeds, but a nice thing to go bimbling about the countryside in. So I think what they're doing is launching this new car, which I can't imagine that they'd ever go to the effort of doing two concept cars, even one, if there wasn't serious production intent behind it. And let's face it, this is the way, you know, all these car manufacturers are going to have to go at some stage. So I think they're laying the ground, and they're showing us the motor and the batteries and the technology. And then when they get it in a super slippery car, then they'll start talking about the range. And I think that would be really, really interesting. I mean, I'm old enough to remember... you were still in short trousers, the Caterham 21, which came out in, when was it, 94, 95, and got stuffed by the Lotus Elise, sadly. But that was the last time Caterham tried to build something other than a 7, or if you don't include the Alpine project. But I think this is a very real, you know, opportunity for them. Don't forget, the Caterham is now owned by a Japanese company. It's probably got levels of investment that it hasn't enjoyed before. And yeah, so the long and the short of it is, I think that is what is happening. And what do I think of it? I actually think it's good news, because it's never going to be, well, certainly not for years and years, you know, all that Caterham makes. They're not going to suddenly stop building Sevens and only start building EV Caterhams. It'll be another model in the range. And I can absolutely see that there will, because there's absolutely nothing out there like it at the moment, somebody who likes the idea of a purely recreational car that is environmentally friendly and quiet and, you know, they're just like, yeah, as I say, just touring around. It won't need a lot of range because it's never going to do huge distances. That way they can keep it light. They can keep it true to Caterham values to some extent. I think there's, yeah, I wouldn't say I'm excited about it, but I can see what it's about. I can see who it's for. And as long as it doesn't come at the expense of anything else, why wouldn't you welcome it?
Mm. Yeah, I agree. And actually, if there is a different car coming with an electric powertrain and it's not a Seven, maybe that would explain why we're looking at a 51 kilowatt hour battery.
Exactly.
Actually quite a substantial battery, because a Seven probably doesn't need that. So yeah, interesting one. We'll follow that one.
So what sort of range do you think it would need to have? And by range, I don't mean, you know, some WLTP nonsense. I mean, you get in the car at home in the morning, it's fully charged. And okay, it will charge reasonably quickly. And so you probably won't be the end of the world if you have to charge it up. But you know, what are we looking at? 150 miles?
I think 150 genuine usable miles is
it's fine,
right?
Isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I was in the Brecon Beacons the other day, and I saw, I think, 60 or 70 Caterhams. And there's this annual run that they do. They go
I know. It starts almost next door to me.
Yes, it does.
I was also in the Brecon Beacons, but I was running, so I couldn't take part in it. They told me about it and asked me to come along, but I couldn't.
Did they? And they go all the way up to the coast, don't they, in Wales?
They go up to North Wales, yeah.
Yeah, so they go a long way. So for that sort of thing, you need much more range from your electric Caterham. But I just, maybe you're not doing that sort of journey in that car.
But even if you are, you won't be doing that very often. So maybe, let's say you do that once a year, which is all that most people will do. And you think to yourself, okay, fine, I'm going to take my new Seven. I mean, you might worry about being tittered at by other Seven drivers, but you just plan it out and you find somewhere in mid Wales where you can just park up, have a coffee. And that's probably all, because it's, what are they going to do? 220 miles, something like that?
Mm.
And I think they go up there, stay overnight and then come back the next day. So even that is not off the cards.
No. If you think about how you use your own Seven, I mean, when did you, in a day, when did you last do more than 150 miles?
Well, it's a good question. So I can't remember when it was, but not that long ago, I took it down to Sussex. I mean, I live in the Wye Valley, so in the Welsh borders. And that was probably about 150 miles.
Yeah.
But it was ready to get out then.
Mm.
And yeah, I stayed overnight at a mate's place and I could have plugged it in and charged it up again.
Yeah. The point being that these cars are recreations, aren't they? And you're not going to be commuting in them doing regular long journeys. And in something like a 3 Series, you'd need more than 150 miles, I would have thought. But in a Caterham, a pure recreation, that should be plenty.
So look, can we just talk... I'm interested in your view, just on this weight matter. So, okay, so... The concept car, which is obviously on a Seven chassis, is less than 700 kilos. But we'll call it, that's whatever that would mean. That could be 699, couldn't it? So that's basically the same, or makes no difference, as the original Elise was in 1995 with its aluminium brakes and so on. So, as we said earlier, by any standards other than Caterham's, a really light car. However, this is a concept, and if I'm right about this other car, that's probably going to weigh a bit more, isn't it? If it's got all enveloping body and everything else, and it's probably not going to be so stripped out because they will be aiming at a slightly more comfort-oriented market. So let's say fully road legal with all the gear on it, it's 800 kilos.
Mm.
Is that a heavy or a light car? I can't make my mind up.
It's difficult to know, isn't it? It depends how well appointed the cabin is, how roomy it is, how much storage space, what kind of car it is, you know?
Yeah.
If it's exactly like a 7 and it weighs 800 kilos, that's heavy. If it's closer to, I don't know, an MX-5 and it weighs 800 kilos, that's super light.
Super light. I mean, let's not forget that, you know, when the Elise and the Exige bowed out, they were, I think they were the wrong side of a ton, weren't they?
Yeah, I think by then, yeah.
Certainly anything with that 3.5-litre Toyota engine, that gets a different level of performance. But, you know, they were getting quite hefty, weren't they? So, and again, you know, as long as it doesn't come to the exclusion of anything, as long as you can still buy, I think Caterham should just have this rule that they'll always sell something that weighs less than 500 kilos.
Yeah, yeah.
That should just be a rule.
Yeah.
And agreed. As long as they continue to do that, and that the sort of the heartland, you know, entry-level Caterham is a 550-kilo car. You know, I don't have a problem with an 800-kilo Caterham. I think it's the way the world is going. It certainly be the lightest electric car on sale. And it will be used for such a different purpose to other ones. Whether people will flock to it in sufficient numbers to justify the investment that must have been made to create it, I don't know, because, you know, it's a kind of new area of the market for Caterham. It's a sort of, I'll tell you what it is, it's the sort of area of the market that Morgan have plundered very well for years. You know, they have, you know, they have made the vast majority of their cars have been, whether it's three-wheeler or sort of four-fours, that sort of thing, they've been quite modest performance touring cars. And you don't often see them screaming around tracks at track days, but you often see them, you know, I see them coming up the Wye Valley Road,
sure.
Because it's a nice, you know, sunny day, car club, you know, noggin and natter in the local, that kind of car. And I see this new Caterham, if I'm right at all about it, I may be entirely wrong, this may be a totally redundant podcast, but if I'm right, that's what I see it being. And that's, it is, you know, it's a, Caterham have been on the fringe of that market, but it'll be interesting to see how it goes.
So we'll see what a Caterham without a snorty petrol engine, without a manual gearbox is like. I will say that, I know it's not the same, but I actually quite enjoy the delivery of an electric motor, that rush. But what, you know, this thing is going to have a load of torque, and it'll have a load of torque from nothing. Caterhams, as we know them, do not have any kind of chassis electronics. And just imagine in the wet, with 240 horsepower and a load of torque from nothing. I just wonder, is this new hypothetical car that we're discussing going to have some sort of safety systems?
I think it probably will, but it's so easy to do these days. I mean, my understanding is that the powertrain is an adapted off-the-peg motor bought in from something else, which is, you know, in these days of EVs, is terribly easy to do. And then it's just, you know, a question of, you know, going to a supplier, getting the relevant sensors and software, and Bob's your uncle. You've got anything you want. You've got ABS, yeah. You've got traction control, you've got stability control. But also, what I would really like Caterham to do, and I think we are just starting to see this in a few electric cars now, is break that. We always say that, you know, one of the problems with electric cars, or problems as we see it, is that they go from nothing to everything instantly. And that's actually quite a disconcerting experience. But there's no need for that to happen. They were like that because that's what they do naturally, and because, you know, they needed a USP. They needed to be, particularly in the high performance cars, different to ICE cars, because, you know, they didn't sound as nice or didn't sound like anything at all. They didn't have that kind of sort of emotional dimension to them. So they just, well, we'll just make them feel bloody fast instead. And that's what all the Teslas did. But there's no reason at all you can't program an electric motor to deliver its power in a much more progressive way. And that's what I'd really like this thing to see. I would like this thing to, I mean, probably not quite have the torque curve of a, you know, an old Crossflow 1700, but nevertheless, just not do that meat and two veg, bang, you know, off you go. Because, you know, others do that, and I think that a Caterham should offer a more considered, sophisticated driving experience than that. And there's no reason why that can't happen.
Just to demonstrate that British sports cars are not all the same, let's move on to another one, Aston Martin DB12, opposite end of the British sports car spectrum. So this is, we saw it this week, this is the replacement for the DB11. It's clearly derived from the DB11, but actually, This is supposed to be the start of a new era for Aston Martin. They talk about a quantum shift and revolution and all that sort of stuff.
Didn't somebody point out that quantum is actually really small?
Yeah, they did. So, well, I think we can assume that Aston Martin means it's a big leap, however it chooses to phrase it. But, and actually, there is reason to believe that this is a big step, because I think I'm right in saying this is the first series production Aston Martin under the watchful eye of a couple of ex-Ferrari people, Amedeo Felice, the former CEO, now CEO at Aston, and Roberto Fidelli, former engineering boss at Ferrari, now in that role at Aston Martin. It's interesting, isn't it? We've got these two ex-Ferrari guys now applying their way of doing things to an Aston Martin.
Yeah, and look at what's happened to the power.
Bang, straight up.
Bang. It's gone from like 540 to 680 horsepower.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's got a load of power. It's a twin-turbo V8, the AMG 4-litre V8.
Yeah.
The looks are... I mean, I'm going to wait until I see it in the flesh, but...
I'm seeing... This is one of the really... I probably should be mentioning this because there's nothing anyone can do with the information. I'm driving it tomorrow.
Yeah,
if
you are.
If British Airways can get me to France...
Yeah, you're supposed to be over France now.
I'm meant
the moment,
to be in France now, but that's another conversation, another story, which I won't whinge about my first world problems. But yeah, I am driving it tomorrow, but as I'm sure everyone listening to this knows, all these launches now are subject to launch embargoes, whereby the simple agreement is that on condition that you don't say a word about driving the car or what the car is like to drive until a certain date, then we'll let you drive the car. And if you don't agree to that, then you can't drive the car, which I personally think is fair enough. But yeah, I mean, so you were talking about the looks. I just want to see it in the flesh.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I really like the look of the DB11. I thought that was an absolutely cracking, classically proportioned Aston Martin GT car. And this new one, I just can't... I don't know whether it's because the press handouts have, you know, have had a bit of work on them, but it's just... I can't make my mind up about it. I think if I think if it had just been launched like that, and we didn't know there'd never been a DB11, we might think be sitting here thinking, wow. I just don't know whether it's going to be more...
That's interesting, because I can take or leave the DB11 in terms of appearance.
Really?
Yeah, I don't love it. I never did love it.
No, I always thought it was great.
So the new DB12, it's got a load of clever technology, as you'd kind of expect from those ex-Ferrari guys. EDIF, new trick adaptive dampers, very clever stability control. They've called it DB12. But for now, there's no word on the 12-cylinder version. Do you know if there it will ever be one? What are you hearing about that?
Well, I can tell you what I've been told. And you always have, you know, to do this business for long enough, as you know, just as well as me, you have to interpret manufacturer speak. So if they say to you, there's not going to be a V12 version of this car, that doesn't mean there's not going to be a V12 version of this car. What it probably means is there may be a V12 version of this car, but either it hasn't been greenlit yet, or it's more than my job's worth to tell you about it, or there absolutely is going to be a V12 version of this car, but we're going to call it slightly something different, so that when you turn around to me and say, you never said there was a DB12 version, and you say, well, aha, this is the DB13.
Yes.
And they won't use that, well, a DB14. So, you know, so even if they say to you, we are absolutely categorically never going to put a V12 engine in this car, you don't know they're never, ever going to put a V12 engine in that car. Okay, what I do know, I think I can say this. Yeah, I do know, I can say this. The V12 is not dying.
Ooh. Okay. So it's not being killed by Euro 7?
Aston Martin will continue to make V12 engines. I presume, because I haven't heard of a V12 version of the AMG engine, that means they'll continue to use the existing 5.2-litre V12 that they've used in the DBS and the DB11. And I also presume that that is going to be, for now at least, and let's not forget we'll see this car this year as well, that's going to be kept for the DBS replacement, which isn't going to be called the DBS. All I know about that is it's going to begin with the letter V. I genuinely don't know what it's going to be called. If I had to guess, I would say Vanquish, but that is absolutely a guess. The Vanquish was meant to be the mid-engine car, which comes after the Valhalla, which came after the Valkyrie. But when you put this to anybody at Aston Martin, they sort of give you a bit of a grin and a sort of, I can neither confirm nor deny looks. I really don't know. But the DB12 lives on. So would they keep that engine in production if they were never going to put it in the DB12. I don't know.
Clear as mud. we're just going to have to wait and see, aren't we?
What I do think is interesting, all that stuff you were talking about the eDiff, it's interesting, the V8 Vantage had an eDiff,
yeah,
but the DB11 didn't. The DBS didn't have an eDiff. They both had just conventional mechanical lockers. So actually, it's not getting anything, which the Vantage hasn't had for years, but nevertheless. But the adapter, the clever adaptive damping. Also, it's got a bespoke Michelin Pilot 5S tyre on it. Mm. I didn't know the 5S was out.
No.
Now, you know, anybody listening to this knows, you know, the massive admiration we have for the 4S. And this has got the next generation of that tyre on it, and it's bespoke to this car. Now, what I find surprising about this is you go and buy yourself a Valkyrie, yeah, for a bazillion pounds, and that comes on Michelin Pilot Cup 2R tyres. But those aren't specific to the Valkyrie. They're really off-the-peg tyres.
Mm.
Michelin didn't, you know, so Aston Martin didn't feel the need or didn't have the money to develop a bespoke tyre even for their hypercar, for the hypercar. But they've done it for the DB12. So what does that tell you about the change in attitude at Aston Martin or the change in resources or both? I just find that it's a little detail. But in many ways, to me, I think it's very telling. I think what it says to me is that these Italians have just said, "Okay, we're just gonna, you know, put our weight behind the engineering,
yeah,
and not just make cars that are great looking. We're going to actually make cars which, you know, like the Ferraris that they engineered.
Well, there you go.
Every bit to good as to drive as they were to look at.
And a bespoke tyre is what Ferrari would do, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I might get in tomorrow and discover that it's terrible. Who knows? I doubt it, but I just find these little details. You know, someone somewhere, you know, there would have been some quite high level meetings where the engineering team said, "Well, of course, what we'd really, really like is this brand. We've heard that this brand new Michelin tyre. Michelin are the best, and it's the 5S. And we all know how good the 4S is. But wouldn't it be great if we not only had the 5S, but we could get them to do one specifically developed for this car? That would have been the dream. That would have been the goal." And instead of just the usual sort of, "Well, yeah, wouldn't it be nice, but come on, you know, get real, we're not made out of money," someone's just gone around and said, "Do it.
Let's do it." Yeah. Yeah. It potentially tells us a lot, doesn't it? And
yeah, maybe.
The other big thing about this car is the brand new interior. And I've only seen a couple of images, but it does look pretty special with, they call it a state-of-the-art infotainment system. And actually, until now, most of the tech in Aston Martin's has been pretty outdated, hasn't it?
Dreadful.
So you'll have to let us know, well, A, what the car's like to drive, how it looks, but also what this new interior is like. Do you know when you can tell us?
Well, I think I can tell you, well certainly with Aston Martin's recently, they have said when you get to go to drive the car, I had this with the DBS 770 Ultimate, which I drove not that long ago, and they said you can say anything as long as you don't tell people what it's like to drive.
Oh, okay.
So I think I can say what the interior is like. What I can certainly do is take a photograph of the interior and post it and people can see. But I won't be able to tell you whether the car's any good until, I can't remember what the date is, but it's sometime in June. Basically, it's the day after everybody who's invited to drive it has driven it.
Okay, fair enough. So it's going to be at least a couple of weeks before we get to find out what it's like to drive. But it's a big, important car for Aston Martin. I hope they've done a good job on it. We'll find out.
Well,
soon.
I think it's, you know, it's like, you know, when there is a big change, as there has been in Aston Martin, the first car that results after that change is always big, isn't it? Because it's you know, whatever it is one thing, but what it signifies is something else. And I don't know how long Felicia and Fedeli have been around and how finished the car was by the time they arrived. But I suspect they've been there for long enough to be able to... do you remember when Uli Betts turned up there? Well, you probably won't, because you would have still been at school. When the Vanquish came out the original Vanquish in 2001. And we all got terribly excited about this car. He turned up and had a look at it and said, "Well, we're not launching that." And he just stopped it.
Yeah. Yeah,
and he was absolutely right. He just said it wasn't right. It wasn't ready. I can't remember what the delay was, but he was new boy on the block, turned up, sort of walked in, quite a domineering personality. Put a lot of backs up, but did a lot of good stuff, certainly in his early days. And just said, we're not doing this. We can't put this car on sale. It's not ready.
Yeah. They like to leave their mark, don't they, early on. And it's probably important that they do. So we'll see what the Italian duo in charge now have been working on. Okay, let's keep clipping it along then. We need to... we're going to be talking about sports cars versus supercars in a moment. But before that, just something a little bit different. Our car finance partner, JBR Capital, they've given us this list of the most unusual cars that they've financed. So I just wanted to run through some of these because it's really surprising. Honestly, one of them at least, I had to Google because I had no clue what it was. The Nissan NPT90. Ever heard of an NPT90? I didn't know what that was.
I had heard of it. But I would consider myself to be, a geek's geek when it comes to such things. Even I had to go and remind myself. But yeah, I had heard. It's an IMSA car,
so an endurance racing prototype.
From the early 1990s. So if you remember, though, do you remember that Mark Blundell lap of Le Mans in 1990, where, his wastegate's jammed shut and all the engineers were shouting, abort lap in his headphones, and he went around and took 5 seconds off the lap record or whatever. It's the sort of the American racing version of that. Much more successful over there than the Group C equivalent was in the World Sports Car Championship. I think it won 2 championships, maybe even 3, certainly 2 championships back to back. And really the opposition by then was, the Jaguars and things like that. But a great looking car, must have been absolutely thunderous to listen to.
Proper thing.
And clearly there's one, I don't know whether it gets driven or it's in a collection or whatever, but somebody's gone to JBR and said, I'm thinking about buying this Nissan. Mm. And they probably said, I'm not sure, is it a GTR?
We don't do many of this.
I said, no, it's not GTR. It's an IMSA car. But it's quite cool that they will, they'll look at that and they'll give you on its value and its residuals and pony up.
They've also done a McLaren 720 GT3. It's another racing car. And actually on that topic, they did a Porsche 962, which is just extraordinary.
See, I always thought, And this is me having rich man's fantasies, insofar as I'm sure we all do. You just sit there and you dream about what you do. But I thought a 962 would be a very good investment because they're sufficiently plentiful. So if you imagine you got something like a Group C Jaguar, they're so rare and so specialist. And I imagine the bits, if you can get them, cost bazillions. And there are probably only 2 or 3 people you can go to who know how to fix and fettle them. But 962s, I mean, they made... I'm not sure, but well over 100 cars. And by the end of it, it wasn't even Porsche just making. There were people making chassis. There were carbon chassis for 962s and hybrid chassis for 962s. And there's so much expertise. And also those cars were so well developed over such a long period of time. They were just, they're just pretty reliable things as well. And so I don't know whether this car's, I presume it's a privateer car. But what a thing to have.
Yeah, brilliant. Really
what
cool.
A thing to turn up at your track day in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, just monster everybody.
You would.
So on the list, we've got an Elva Mark 7, which is a very pretty little under 2 litre sports racing car from the early 60s.
Yeah, so that if you know what a Lotus 23 is, you kind of know what an Elva Mark 7 is. It's a beautiful little thing. So you can get them with all sorts of engines in there. You get Ford engines, Porsche engines, BMW engines. So you kind of bought the car and then decided what you were going to do with it and got it the powertrain that was best for whatever it was you were going to try and do in it. And they were very successful. I think they were very successful in the US as well as over here. And I think Elva went on, which is why we now have the McLaren Elva, to build the custom McLaren Can-Am cars.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that makes sense.
I think that, so McLaren, back in the days of the sort of big bang Can-Am series in the late 60s and early 70s, McLaren made their own factory cars, things like the M8D and the M8F, but they also made customer cars, which are things like the M8C and the M8E. And I think, someone's going to tell me how incredibly wrong I am about this, but I think Elva bought those for McLaren because McLaren didn't have the capacity to do it themselves.
There you go. That explains the Elva link.
That's the Elva connection.
How familiar are you with the Mosler MT900?
Well, only quite familiar, but only because when they were quite the thing in racing circles, I did a few 24-hour races in things like Mazda RX-8s, and we were at one end of the grid, and the Moslers were down the other end of the grid. They were so fast.
Really?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I would say that in the Silverstone 24-hour race from the sort of middle noughties, they'd have been the fastest thing out there. They'd have been quicker than, you know, race 911s and all the other stuff that was around. And they were very, well, they were sophisticated cars. I mean, if you look at it and you think, oh, it's just, you know, so, you know, Mosler, I haven't heard of that. You discover it's American, you think, oh, well, it's just a big banger. But carbon fiber chassis. I think it had an LT6 engine in it. Porsche gearbox. Really, actually, quite a sophisticated car.
And, aero.
Yeah, aero. Very, very light. I mean, you know, much, I mean, they were called the MT900 because, well, M was Mosler, T was, I think, the engineer who developed it, and 900 was the target weight for the car. It was meant to be a 900-kilo car. I don't think it ever got anywhere near it. I don't think they ever came in under a ton. But nevertheless, compared to almost anything else out there, they were not only really, really powerful, you know, really stiff, really strong, they were really light too. Which is why they did. I mean, they won championships. I mean, quite serious championships. I think, did one win British GT? Don't know. But that level of championship on both sides of the Atlantic and around Europe for quite a period of time. I think it all went, I think they must have gone out of production or something happened and it was all over by about 2010. But for a short period in the early part of the century, they were quite the thing.
Quite serious.
And not
things,
to be sniffed at all.
Yeah. So the final one on this list of unusual cars that JBR Capital have financed, Ferrari 250mm.
Oh.
What do you make of that?
Oh, I mean,
that's a valuable car, isn't it?
Well, yes, of course it is. Yeah, I mean, any 250mm, if it's a genuine 250mm, is, which, you know, I'm sure this one is a valuable car. But how much, it just so much depends on the provenance and the history and what it's done and whether it has that, you know, Ferrari Classico certificate. And so the 250mm was one of the early V12s, not one of the earliest. I think they were around in the sort of early 50s, 52, 53. But with a 250 is the capacity of a single cylinder. So multiply that by 12, you get 3 litres. That's usually the size of the engine. So that was the Colombo 3-litre V12, which they were still using as a 3-litre V12 in things like the 250 short wheelbase and the GTO. This wonderful, enduring, powerful, strong engine. And back in the early 50s, you know, Ferraris really, really, really were all about the engine. By the early 60s, they kind of figured out they needed to handle a bit too, but by then they weren't bothered about that at all. So they were put in these very, very crude agricultural chassis. And I imagine, I've never driven one, but I imagine that something like that is a right handful. I've chased a few of them when I've been either chasing myself or taking part in the Mille Miglia retrospective. They're very popular. I say very popular. I think they only made 30, but you see them a bit on that sort of event. They make the most unbelievable noise. And they also come from that era where there were lots of different bodies. So there's no such thing as what does a 250mm look like, because you can go and, you know, look them up on the internet and you'll see three different photographs and they'll all say 250mm and you'll be looking at three different cars. So yeah, they did open ones, they did closed ones, they had different body styles, probably from different body makers too. But yeah, cracking thing, proper brawny, hairy chest, early V12 Ferrari sports racing car.
It's fantastic.
I mean, millions, certainly.
The point of all this is that unlike some car finance companies, JBR Capital will at least have a look at anything that you might want to finance. I'm not saying they will agree to pull together a finance package for you, but they will have a look at anything, even if it's an obscure old racing car or a little known sports car or something. It won't just be computer says no.
It'd be interesting. I mean, when anybody sort of says, we'll do anything, I immediately start thinking about, I bet you I can think of something that you want. I don't know.
But when there's stuff on their list that you and I both have to Google to find out what on earth it is, it shows they're pretty flexible, doesn't it? It's interesting stuff. What Goes Up is sponsored this week by car finance specialist JBR Capital. We've been working with JBR Capital for a while now, and it's been a brilliant partnership for us. High-end car finance is all the company does, meaning it understands the car market and car buyers better than most. So before you buy your next sports car, supercar, classic car, luxury car, even a brand new car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. Visit jbrcapital.com or click the link in description. And this bit is important. Tell them the Intercooler sent you. JBR Capital is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Okay, so sports cars versus supercars. I was pondering this yesterday. That's why we're talking about it now. And actually, do you know, I wanted this to be a bit of a debate. I wanted you to choose back supercars and I would back sports cars. And we both explain why, if forced to, we would give up one rather than the other. And I was going to explain why I would give up supercars to save sports cars. And you were going to say why you would give up all sports cars to save all supercars. The trouble is,
probably haven't been very helpful, have I?
No, we both agree, don't we? We'd both choose sports cars.
Yes, but the thing is, it's most of the time, and I suppose gun to head, you would, because you know the thing. Well, I mean, maybe we should just spend a minute explaining what we mean by a sports car and a supercar. But fundamentally, you're going to spend more time driving sports cars than supercars, and so you're going to have more fun.
Yeah.
But okay, so what to you differentiates a sports car from a supercar? And let's have some examples.
Okay, so the best example that I can offer you right now is the original Audi R8. V8 engine, that's a sports car. V10 engine, that's a supercar.
Wow, it's a balance that fine.
It's there you go. That I think is where the line is.
Okay.
Although it's constantly moving, and I don't think I can really tell you quite why.
Maybe what's an Aston Vantage?
Sports car.
Aston Vantage V12.
Oh, well, do you know what? The latest one, because it's quite an out there thing, that probably is a supercar.
So this is a very... And I guess the point is that there's absolutely no right or wrong with it. Everybody's dividing line is going to be different, isn't it?
Yeah, and it moves all the time. Also, let's choose the 911. So for me, everything up to and including a Carrera GTS is a sports car. Anything beyond that is a supercar.
I don't agree with that.
No, I know. But the thing is, but I can't look at a GT3 Touring, for instance, and say that's a supercar.
But I can't even look at a Turbo S and say that's a supercar.
Really?
No.
So you think they're all sports cars?
I think, because to me, 911s are sports cars. Mm. Now, you could... I think years and years ago, I think you told me earlier we were on our 163rd podcast. I think we had a conversation, probably the thick end of 3 years back, when we tried... got ourselves tied in terrible knots to define what we thought a supercar was and what the differences were. And to me, it's just an entirely conceptual thing in your head. And 911 Turbo S, if you look at it on paper, you'd say, well, it's performance, it's power, everything else. Well, that's a supercar.
Mm.
But then you get these things called junior supercars.
Yeah, you do. It's complicated, isn't it?
Are all Ferrari supercars? To me,
see, something like a Portofino, though. Isn't that a GT? Is that something else again?
Yes, that's something else. Okay, let me rephrase it. Are no Ferrari sports cars? Because obviously a Pura Sangue is not to me a supercar because it's got four doors and supercars don't have four doors. Mm. A Portofino. Is a Roma a supercar?
I'd say GT again.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? But maybe we shouldn't go round and round in circles.
It doesn't really matter. That's the point. It doesn't actually matter at all.
Okay, so here's a quick. You can go and spend a weekend doing whatever you like in your choice of Caterham, your choice of Ferrari from production cars. I'm not talking about you know, esoterica.
Mm. Okay, well, because it's a hypothetical scenario, and because I can therefore choose to have spa for a day, and then maybe blast around some of the roads in that part of the world, I'll choose the Ferrari. Because it's a hypothetical situation, and I can create this scenario where the Ferrari would come into its own. However, if you offer me one tomorrow, and I have to be, you know, I'm staying at home tonight and tomorrow night, so I have to be based from where I live, I'd probably choose the Caterham, because I don't have all day, I can only go so far, I can only go on certain roads, I can't get on a racetrack. For me, they are less frustrating on the road. They are typically smaller, lighter, and simpler cars, so they're often more engaging to drive at road speeds. I wrote about driving a Series 1 Lotus Elise for the first time quite recently, and I adored that thing. It was just so absorbing, so engaging. You're so much a part of the process of driving, like you are in a Caterham. In a sports car, you often have more space on the road because they're smaller. They often deal with bad road surfaces, and we have plenty of those, better than a supercar.
Often they don't, but okay, go on.
No, yeah, of course, there are exceptions. But think, a sports car may well have more wheel travel, may well have smaller wheels, and that will help it deal with a bumpy, bad road surface better. You're more likely to get a manual gearbox in a sports car than a supercar these days. I think that's just a fact.
Definitely. Well, name a manual supercar.
Well, there you go. There you go. I'm not sure I can at the moment. Anyway, a sports car is going to have probably less reliance on chassis electronics because it won't have so much power. Let's not forget that sports cars are cheaper to buy. They're cheaper to run. They're often more usable. You've probably got better ground clearance. Not in every case, but they're also not so wide. Probably a more supple ride quality.
I think, well, on that exact point, I think a really significant consideration is the people I know, unless they're really very wealthy, most of the people I know who have supercars, they are concerned, understandably so, about how many miles they put on them. Because if you have supercars, you know, you know that the residual value of that car is so dependent, so much more dependent than any other category of car in how few miles it's done, which is about as big a disincentive to drive it as you'll get. And I just don't want to think to myself, oh, I probably better not drive the Ferrari this weekend on that wonderful trip to Scotland. I'll take the Range Rover instead because, you know, I'm going to put 1,000 miles on the car and that'll take a bazillion pounds off its value. I mean, where's the fun in that?
Yeah, it's a big consideration, that one. It's a very big consideration.
Yeah, and it stops people enjoying their cars.
Just to look back to something we discussed earlier. So the news of the DB12, okay, I'm interested in that car. I would be hopping in my seat right now if that was news of an Aston Martin sports car to sit beneath the Vantage.
Smaller.
I know. But I'm just dreaming. I'm fantasizing. But if it was going to happen, maybe with a little V6 or something, I'd be so excited about that car. Yeah. Much more than I am about the DB12.
Yeah, but as we've discussed on this podcast time and time again, we're weird.
Well, we are weird. I know. I'm not saying Aston Martin should build one. I'm just saying if they did, I mean,
it would die on its ass.
It would. It would.
They'd probably sell quite a few, but they'd never get back the investment cost. It would move their brand into an area of the market they've been trying to escape from, frankly. And while a few slightly silly petrol heads like you and me would go, oh, isn't that wonderful?
Mm.
Everybody else would go, well, that's not an Aston Martin because it hasn't got 600 horsepower.
Mm. Yeah, nevertheless, it would be the one that I'd be most excited about. There's also, you know, sports cars tend to be subtler than supercars. Not as noisy, not as brash, not as outlandish in their styling. And there is something about that for me. You know, sometimes it's quite fun to be turning heads in your supercar. But when you just want to get to where you're going, under the radar, you don't want to be noticed, I'd far rather be in a sports car. Far rather.
Okay, can I mount the case for the defence? And there is an element of devil's advocacy in here, because as we have already agreed, push comes to shove, sports cars are where it's at. Nevertheless, I think that there are certain supercars which can take you places figuratively, not literally, that sports cars just can't. Let me give you, I mean, the best example I can think of, our mate RS Driver has just taken delivery of a very late brand new McLaren 720S. And, you know, he has a superb collection of wonderful cars. But there aren't many that I'm more jealous of than that. Only because I once spent 6 months with one. And the novelty of that car, I think almost unlike anything else I've ever run, never, ever wore off. It never lost its capacity to absolutely astound me. And it would do it in different ways. I've talked about this trip before, but it just lives with me. I took it to Geneva and back for when Geneva had a motor show. And I drove it out one day. I did the show the following day and drove it home the day after that. Did about, I don't know, whatever it is, 1,500 miles, maybe a bit more, over the mountains in both directions. And that car's ability to cruise down a motorway, 80 miles an hour, listening to music, be quiet, really comfortable, beautiful visibility, really feeling good about myself, but, you know, just being a car. And then suddenly to change character, turn into a something completely different, which was one of the most thrilling devices you could ever choose to punt across the right kind of road. And I know that big white supercars often don't find the right kind of road. I found that absolutely compelling. And a breadth of ability that I don't think that any sports car has. Now, I'm not saying, therefore, supercars are better than sports cars, not at all. What I am saying is that there are, nevertheless, circumstances you can find yourself in where a supercar can still do things other cars can't do. Mm. The right sort of supercar.
And I will admit that the right sort of supercar or hypercar can reach higher heights. If you want the most thrilling, the most intoxicating driving experience, maybe it does need to be a supercar or a hypercar. However, you need either a racetrack or a very particular type of road. You need a remote road, a quiet road.
Yeah.
You need a,
if you just
a smooth
get in your car,
road.
You're completely right. I mean, I can get in my Caterham, which on a really, really good day has 135 horsepower. And I will be enjoying that car literally less than a mile from where I live, because you just can. And you can't do that in supercars. You're absolutely right. You need a very specific environment for them to come into their own. And when they do, they are different, and they are better. But, you know, it's this thing that I've talked about so many times, the amount of fun a car providing being how much, how enjoyable it is, multiplied by the number of times you get to drive it.
So for me, to summarise, sports cars are fun more often, but a supercar in the right environment takes you to higher heights.
So that's slightly strange, isn't it? Because that is a qualitative versus a quantitative measure. And you would think that you and I would go for quality over quantity every time. But we don't, because actually out there in the real world, we would rather have slightly less fun a lot more often than the other way around.
Yeah. And it's probably because of the way our roads are now. They're busy. You're being watched by goodness knows who. There's not a lot of space, poor road surfaces. And so the upshot of all that is that a sports car is more likely to be fun more often. So that's why. Guns to my head, I would choose sports cars.
A genuine, proper sports car, £1,500.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, yeah.
Good luck getting a supercar for that.
For anything like that money. There you go. Okay, well, we'll leave it there. I'm not going to do a listener question because it's been a busy episode. We'll do one next week. But thank you, everybody, for listening. And make sure you tune in next week as well.
Bye.
Hmm.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.